Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service, with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
Institutional investors deserve tailored portfolio solutions created by investment experts who understand their portfolio needs. MetLife Investment Management's client-first approach to managing public fixed income, private capital, and real estate assets is institutional, but far from typical. Learn more at MetLife.com/institutional. That's MetLife.com/institutional.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Valerie Sanderson, and at 13 hours GMT on Wednesday, the 13th of May, these are our main stories. How have people in China reacted to a lockdown in the city of Jilin after a fresh cluster of COVID-19 cases emerges? A roadmap is outlined aimed at getting Europe moving again after coronavirus restrictions are eased. So, what will this plan involve? Also,
at least now I don't have to borrow money from anyone. Today I earned around $3, but other days it's nothing.
The plight of millions of Pakistanis living in poverty who simply can't afford to be in lockdown. Also in this podcast,
just about everybody I've seen today has worn a mask. Yeah.
Were you the one who required that, sir?
Yeah, I did. I required it, yes.
As the Trump administration grapples with the pandemic, worries grow over how COVID-19 is spreading, even into the White House, and how the humble moth could be a powerful force for good. First, it was Wuhan. Now there's been a second outbreak of COVID-19 in the Chinese city of Jilin, more than 2,000 kilometres away, up near the border with Russia and North Korea. Dozens of new cases have been reported and the authorities have imposed new restrictions. In Wuhan, where the pandemic started, all 11 million inhabitants are being tested. Well, shortly before we recorded this podcast, I asked our China media analyst, Kerry Allen, what do we know about how the new outbreak in Jilin came about?
It all started with a laundry worker who tested positive in a city called Shulan last week. But what is unclear is how she was able to get the virus. She tested positive, but she hadn't been in contact with anybody else who'd had the virus. And so the authorities are now looking at whether she might have caught it off clothing because she had literally been staying indoors and only seeing her mother and travelling by car, so not travelling by public transport.
And the authorities have been pretty quick, haven't they, to test. What else are they doing?
They've been extremely quick. So instantly they've stopped train and long distance bus services. They've banned social gatherings straight away, indoor public venues, things like theatres, internet cafes, public bathhouses have just been closed until further notice. And they've been able to trace anybody since who started showing symptoms. And there have been 21 confirmed cases in the last week of COVID-19, not only in Shulan, but also in Jilin City. So both of these two major cities have imposed these lockdown measures. And more than 200 people are now being tested for the virus who've come into contact with these new cases.
And what about the authorities in neighbouring places?
Yes, so this is a major concern at the moment because there has been an extra confirmed case of COVID-19 in neighbouring Liaoning province. And what's happening is that China is asking provinces and provincial level regions to take responsibility for this. So this is why we're seeing in Jilin, the case of Shulan and Jilin City, straight away imposing lockdowns. But what is now going to happen is if cases grow in Liaoning, all the different cities in this region are going to have to impose similar lockdowns. So they're being very, very careful and trying to isolate cases that this person who's got the virus might have come into contact with.
And how are the public reacting to this?
Well, amazingly, they're actually staying quite positive. I mean, people have seen that Wuhan has come out of lockdown and that people are starting to go back to school, starting to go back to work. And so they're saying if Wuhan was able to survive this and come through this, then you will too. So there's a lot of positivity online. The platform Sina Weibo, which is China's version of Twitter, lots of people saying you'll get through this. We've been through this. You'll get through it too.
Kerry Allen, our China media analyst. It's a plan to give people the confidence to travel again and the chance to get some well-needed rest, relaxation and fresh air. That's how the European Commission, the executive arm of the EU, describes its roadmap back towards freedom of movement. The Commission recommends that member states bring to an end the blanket restrictions on travel. Here's the EU Commissioner, Margrethe Vestager.
Tourism is a vital part of Europe's economy. Nearly a tenth of GDP across Europe and more than 10% in 11 member states. Millions of jobs depend on tourism, and that often in areas where there aren't many other industries. And tourism gives those regions both security and hope for all that work there.
Our Europe correspondent, Gavin Lee, is in Brussels, and shortly before the announcement, he told me about the roadmap.
There are three elements to it. Basically, it's about, in the words of the Commission spokesperson in a briefing that I've had, the right of individuals for the need to rest, relaxation, fresh air and see families in other countries. Now, it depends, of course, on the situation, the Commission says, of how bad the extent of the virus is spreading and whether it remains fairly calm and there isn't a second spike. But what they're looking at is setting out a roadmap for tourism and travel and holidays as of this summer, so summer 2020 and onwards. And a couple of the areas include making sure, of course, it's slow, it's progressive. There will be some kind, we're told, of guide that if you're going on holiday somewhere in Europe, there should be an indication of what are the COVID prevention strategies in each country that you might go to, what are the hotel strategies, and also there will be a recommendation that individual hotels start to advertise, put themselves on the market in what they can offer your average tourist and holidaymaker in terms of COVID prevention, cleanliness, ability to sanitise, things like that. That should be part of the, you know, the new holiday brochures, for example. Now, these are all recommendations. So that's one element. The other thing is about airlines. A number of countries, 14 countries, have said that because of the pressure of the airline industry, give you an example where I am in Brussels, the main airlines here, Brussels Airlines, they've axed, they're going to, a quarter of all jobs, 1,000 staff will go, and about a third of the airline fleet will go as well. Rather than giving money as cash back for people who need refunds for cancelled flights because of COVID, the idea is to give vouchers. Now, the EU Commission will push back in the meeting today to say, no, you can make vouchers more attractive, more appealing, but that should be fundamentally a principle of the right of somebody to have their money back instead. So there's a couple of elements that they're looking at as part of the summer travel plan today.
So if you are within the EU and you want to go on holiday, can you go anywhere?
This is a really good point, and there are two words or two phrases that you might start to hear more and more. One is social travel bubble, a social travel bubble. The second is a travel corridor. So, for example, this Friday, the Baltic states are opening the borders to each other. So Estonia, Latvia, Lithuania, where there's been relatively few cases, along with Finland, are able to travel in and out of each other's countries. So, for example, Estonia relies on tourists from Finland. 40% of its tourists come from there. So this is a big thing, and that will mean free movement for all of those people. The Swiss national broadcaster today have suggested that they will announce later on that the internal borders between Switzerland, Austria, Germany and France will also reopen for internal travel between them. So the idea is that you've got almost an inner social bubble of those countries and the people in those countries going on holiday there, and briefly travel corridors. There's been talk of Denmark, for example, saying that they've had few cases. Could they have a simple flight path to Greece, where there's also been few cases? The Commission says that will be up to member states.
Gavin Lee in Brussels. In Pakistan, lockdown restrictions have been eased this week, even though the country has yet to reach its peak of infections. With more than 32,000 confirmed cases and more than 700 deaths, doctors there are warning that an already weak healthcare system won't be able to cope with a huge surge in cases. Prime Minister Imran Khan, however, has insisted that people pushing for a stricter lockdown are out of touch with the concerns of those living a hand-to-mouth existence who simply can't afford not to work, as Sukunda Kamani reports.
At a market in the outskirts of Islamabad, shoppers are preparing for iftar, the evening meal. breaking the daily fast Muslims perform during Ramadan. Officials have called on people to practice social distancing. But whilst the streets are slightly less busy than usual, there are still plenty out and about. Waiting to collect his fried samosas, one young man insists he's not too worried about coronavirus. If it was so bad, he says, all these people wouldn't be out on the streets. Critics say the government is sending the public mixed messages. Lockdown restrictions have now been significantly eased in most of Pakistan, with the majority of smaller shops allowed at least to partially reopen. But in a country where around 25% live below the poverty line, many are still struggling. Mohammed Munir is a cobbler sat in front of a small stall.
Lots of shops have now opened, but it's not the same as before. At least now I don't have to borrow money from anyone. I can just about get by. Today I earned around $3, but other days it's nothing.
It's not just businesses that are open. Mosques are being allowed to hold communal prayers. Worshippers are meant to follow certain regulations, such as keeping a distance from each other. But at the majority of mosques, it appears that isn't happening. Healthcare workers have expressed their frustration, warning an increase in cases will overwhelm them. As of yet, the number of coronavirus deaths in Pakistan has been relatively low, though some are likely to be undetected.
It long-term planning of mulki, short-term, medium-term, long-term, it puri vision bane hamari jo hum uske par pure lage hue hain.
No one is quite sure how bad it will get, but Prime Minister Imran Khan has been clear. He believes poverty is a bigger threat than coronavirus. The government has begun a major effort to distribute food and money to the most needy, but he says the state simply can't reach everyone and that lockdowns are a luxury for the rich.
The rich aren't thinking about what will happen to the poor man, the labourer, the rickshaw driver, who works all day just to put food on the table for his children. The elite wants to decide for the whole country.
Imran Khan has at times appeared out of step with local authorities in the country's different provinces, some of whom have spoken in support of extending restrictions, accusing Khan of not taking coronavirus seriously enough. But there are others also warning that the reaction to the COVID-19 pandemic risks causing more harm than the disease itself in developing world countries.
Sukunda Kamani. They're already back in South Korea. Germany is on the way this weekend and England could be returning soon. I'm talking about football leagues, of course, but not all are trying to defy the coronavirus and finish their seasons. Cameroon has become the latest country to bring their domestic league to a premature conclusion, crowning new champions in the process. I heard more from Jonathan Savage.
Well, Valerie, football at all levels has been brought to a conclusion in Cameroon for this season. The decision was there would be winners but no losers, but another way, champions but no relegation. So the men's champions are PWD Bameda, who at the time the season was suspended were a point clear at the top with a game in hand. It's Bameda's first title and they're the first club from the Anglophone part of Cameroon to win the league for 11 years. Now, with no relegation, two sides will be promoted to the top tier for next season, expanding that division to 20 teams. And in the Women's League, Louvre Minprof have been declared the champions there. The decision to end the season is one that has been reached in many parts of Africa. Angola, Burkina Faso, Congo, the DRC, Kenya, Mauritius, Niger, they've all abandoned their campaigns. Also, cross-continental competitions have been postponed. The Confederation of African Football's Champions League and Confederation Cup are all indefinitely suspended.
And what does that mean going forward? I mean, how has this outbreak affected clubs and indeed individuals across African football?
Well, there's a huge financial black hole to be filled. Most leagues are not rich, the players aren't rich, and without income from gate receipts and sponsors, football just can't function. For example, the average monthly salary in the Kenyan Premier League is $200. That will get topped up with win bonuses, appearance fees, and money, which really without matches just isn't going to be there. So players across the continent have seen their livelihoods evaporate. There is some help on offer. FIFA has announced an emergency relief fund for associations which many African countries have taken advantage of. Some prize money has been released early. And going back to Cameroon, the football body there, FECA Foot, last month announced plans to financially support clubs and more than 1,000 players and coaches. But that's just $88,000 to be spread across the men and women's game. And while Africa hasn't had the same level of outbreak as some other parts of the world, sport on the continent is crippled by the coronavirus. And it's not coming back soon. Just yesterday, football's governing body in Africa said football must wait.
Jonathan Savage reporting. Still to come in this edition of our podcast.
He has been beyond embarrassing. His narcissism, his blowhardism, his pretending he knows everything when he is clearly ill-informed. It has shocked even me, and my expectations of him were a millimeter high to begin with.
An American-born writer has some harsh words for Mr. Trump's handling of the COVID-19 crisis. There's bad news for the British government, with official figures showing that the economy has suffered its biggest contraction since the financial crisis more than a decade ago. The reason? Coronavirus. The figures come as England, though not the rest of the United Kingdom, began to ease some lockdown restrictions. The Chancellor, Rishi Sunak, says it's very likely that the UK economy will face a significant recession this year due to the coronavirus outbreak.
We're facing severe impact from the coronavirus. You're seeing that in the numbers. And that's why we've taken the unprecedented action that we have to support people's jobs, their incomes, livelihoods at this time, and support businesses so we can get through this period of severe disruption and emerge stronger on the other side.
I asked Rob Watson to take us through the figures.
They're just immensely grim. So GDP has gone down by 2% between January and the end of March. That is the biggest fall since December of 2008, which of course was the collapse of the Lehman Brothers Bank and the start of the financial crisis. And of course, worth bearing in mind that this includes only 1 week of lockdown, because the lockdown in the UK started on 23rd of March, and the statistics suggest that output fell, GDP fell by almost 6% in just March alone on the basis of 1 week.
And lockdown is easing in England today, but we should stress it's only England, it's not other parts, other nations that make up the United Kingdom.
Absolutely worth stressing that, and also to stress the Prime Minister Boris Johnson's own words that these are baby steps. Nobody should be under any illusion outside of the UK that this is a return to normal in England. Far from it. I mean, there is a change of emphasis. So the government is now saying, look, if you can go to work, you should, if your business is a sort of considered a safe place to be going. But the rest of it, I mean, this is still pretty much a severe social isolation. Yes, you're allowed to go and see one other person. You're allowed to take exercise beyond your own neighbourhood. And of course, you could move house and go fishing, which is something I certainly intend to do, Valerie. But apart from that, you know, this is not a return to normal. Far from it.
No, it's baby steps, as you said, Boris Johnson stressed. And that's all about what? The rate of infection?
Yes, the UK's entire plan, to be fair, it's similar to other governments around the world, is conditional. So the Prime Minister laid out a phased return to a sort of normal. I mean, it's not even going to be normal, even at the end of the phased return, taking us all the way through to July, with some schools hopefully opening in June, some more businesses, restaurants possibly in July. But all of it conditioned on the infection rate staying at a sort of manageable level.
Rob Watson. Now, why has a $1 trillion investment fund blacklisted some firms from Canada, Egypt and Brazil? Lawrence Pollard asked business reporter Andrew Wood.
We're talking about the sovereign wealth fund of Norway, which, as you say, is worth $1 trillion. And the Norwegian Central Bank, which looks after this, basically, says that after its ethics committee, its Council on Ethics has met, that it's going to ban investments or in four companies from Canada because of what's called their unacceptable greenhouse gas emissions. And the other three companies, one's in Egypt, two in Brazil, they're miners and power companies, they're being blacklisted for causing severe environmental damage.
Now, there is always an element of hypocrisy thrust at the Norwegians at this point, because, of course, their $1 trillion investment fund is basically quite so large and money-packed because of selling oil and gas, isn't it?
Yeah, it was started back in the 1990s and has grown, you know, to $1 trillion. When you consider this, I think fewer than 10 million Norwegians, you know, $1 trillion between 10 million Norwegians is an awful lot of cash. And yes, I mean, ironically, it means that this sovereign wealth fund can't invest in an awful lot of companies inside Norway because they're involved in producing CO2, in producing carbon emissions. I mean, if you want to be really cynical, I've heard that the Norwegians basically being likened to a drug dealer who basically is making an awful lot of money and then donates some of that money perhaps to look into the causes of drug addiction whilst at the same time continuing to make an awful lot of money. I mean, Norway's a big producer still, 1 million barrels a day last year. That's about 1% of global oil output per day.
Andrew Wood talking to Lawrence Pollard. As President Trump sets out ways to open up the US economy, he's facing a stark example, horribly close to home, of what might happen as restrictions are loosened. COVID-19 is in the White House, as our North America editor John Sopel reports.
The White House is probably one of the most closely guarded buildings in the world. Snipers are on duty on the roof. Heavily guarded fences with a mass of electronics keep out intruders. Secret Service officers swarm around the perimeter. There are no fly zones over the building. There are secret tunnels and bunkers. The US Marine Corps guard the entry to the West Wing. And yet, undetected, the coronavirus has snuck in. At the weekend, it was announced that a senior aide had tested positive for coronavirus. Any mystery about who it might be was quickly dispelled by the president.
Well, I don't know much about it. Does anybody want to talk about it? She's a wonderful young woman. Katie, she tested very good for a long period of time, and then all of a sudden today she tested positive.
The Katie in question is Katie Miller, the Vice President's Communications Director and a spokesperson for the Coronavirus Task Force. And without going into an organogram of the executive branch, Katie Miller is married to Stephen Miller, who's probably the most influential and longest-serving policy advisor to Donald Trump. The upshot is that the VP, Mike Pence, is now in a version of quarantine, so too the Millers, and three key figures on the coronavirus task force. Also, on Monday night, a change.
Just about everybody I've seen today has worn a mask. Yeah.
Were you the one who required that, sir?
Yeah, I did. I did. I required it, yes.
Everyone has now been ordered to wear a face covering while they're in the White House. At his news conference on Monday night in the Rose Garden, everyone was wearing a mask. White House staff, reporters, bodyguards. Well, one person wasn't, but that was hardly a surprise. Donald Trump made clear his views on the day last month his coronavirus task force recommended their use.
Well, I just don't want to wear one myself. It's a recommendation. They recommend it. I'm feeling good.
One of the things that's amazed me since arriving in Washington is the unbelievable access we have to the White House if you have one of the gold dust hard passes. Once you've been through security and as of 4 weeks ago had your temperature taken, you're free to go into the briefing room made famous by any number of movies and, of course, actual briefings. At the side is a sliding door. And from there you press a button and another sliding door opens, and now you're into the West Wing proper. I went to see the President's press secretary a few days ago. She meets the President daily. Her office is probably 12 paces from his. Any journalist with a hard pass is able to wander through without an invitation or appointment to that bit of the West Wing. Now it's face masks everywhere, and some staff have been told they should consider working from home. Coronavirus testing is being introduced for senior staff on a daily basis, where you get the results back in 15 minutes. There'll be temperature checks too. This is prudent, but it highlights an important point about the risks of reopening in the rest of the US. If what is happening today at the White House is the benchmark of what it takes to keep your organisation functioning safely and COVID-free, is there a meatpacking factory, a car plant, a parcel distribution centre, not to mention a hospital, anywhere in America that will be able to offer that to its staff?
John Sopel. The American author Lionel Shriver, who's based here in the UK, has been speaking about her experiences during lockdown. She says that as a writer, she's accustomed to spending most of her time working at home, but at the same time, it's a horrible time to be alive. Connie Sharp asked her what she meant.
For me personally, it's not difficult at all because I live in permanent lockdown. Most writers do if they do their job. So I'm used to sitting in front of my computer all day, and I'm used to my life being pretty boring. That makes me very lucky because, you know, lots of people can't do their work from home.
You've been called or labeled a lockdown rebel. You said it's a horrible time to be alive. What do you mean by that exactly?
You know, the only thing that makes my experience of this dark is knowing what's happening outside my windows. And you can't see it, but little by little, both the UK and the world economy is falling apart. And every day these lockdowns go on, another set of businesses bites the dust. And I don't take that lightly. I have regard for how long it takes to build a successful business, how much you have to put yourself, your time, and your capital at risk. Sometimes it's the labor of decades or generations, and it breaks my heart. I go through a funny emotional arc every day. I have a book on the boards, and so when I'm working on that, I feel fine. But then when I quit for the day and I go down and get a little exercise in front of the news, my demeanor just plummets. It's this feeling of dread. I sort of have a feeling that I do know what the future holds, and it's terrible. I'm worried about everybody far more than I am about myself.
How do you think, you know, the governments that you know well have handled the pandemic so far, not necessarily in the lockdown, but in the way in which they have provided or not provided, for example, PPE equipments or not being as prepared as they should have been? Because everyone knew, all governments were very much aware that this pandemic was going to come.
Oh, there's no question that the PPE situation is a scandal. The UK was not prepared for a pandemic in spite of the fact that it had studied the likelihood and kind of gone through examining what would happen and what would be required, and then it didn't take care of it.
What about the United States?
Oh, well, that's been just a horrifics. I am hopeful that Donald Trump's performance in these nightly news briefings has been sufficiently atrocious and self-evidently atrocious to the point where each one of those broadcasts has functioned as a vote for Joe Biden advert. I mean, he has been beyond embarrassing. His narcissism, his blowhardism, his pretending he knows everything when he is clearly ill-informed. It has shocked even me, and my expectations of him were a millimeter high to begin with.
What are you most looking forward to at the end of lockdown?
Gosh, this is going to sound trite. I just want to meet a friend of mine at a restaurant, right? Or have my friends over to dinner. That's what I miss. I miss the companionship of other people and in person. This Zoom stuff doesn't cut it.
And that was the author, Lionel Shriver, speaking there to Carney Sharp. And finally, moths. They chew holes in clothes and furnishings and rise up in choking clouds when disturbed. But new research here in Britain suggests moths play a critical but overlooked role in distributing pollen, and their networks could even be larger and more complex than bees and butterflies. Our environment correspondent Matt McGrath has more details.
Long seen as fluttering pests that make holes in your clothes, scientists now say we have badly misjudged the humble moth. While bees are widely recognised for their role as pollinators, we have overlooked the same job being done by moths during the hours of darkness. This study, published in the journal Biology Letters, found that pollen often sticks to the moth's hairy body and is then transported to a wide range of plants and flowers during their nighttime travels. Not only are their distribution networks larger and more complex than daytime pollinators, the moths help pollinate species rarely visited by bees and butterflies. The researchers from University College London are concerned because moth numbers are still in serious decline due to pesticides and changes in land use. The moth's real problem is perception, they say, and the key to preserving their vital role isn't regulation, but recognition.
Matt McGrath. And that's it from us for now, but there'll be an updated version of the Global News podcast later. If you want to comment on this edition or the topics we've covered in it, do send us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. I'm Valerie Sanderson. Until next time, bye-bye.